Buckle up, Friedrich Merz had said. When I'm Chancellor, I'll be pushing the pedal to the metal. Now he's in office, and in terms of foreign politics, he truly shifted some gears this week. Okay, enough car references, but hey, this is a German podcast after all. Anyway, let's dive in. Friedrich Merz was asked about his position on Israel and Gaza this week, and he stunned many people with this response.
What the Israeli army is now doing in the Gaza Strip, I no longer understand, frankly, what its objective is. To cause such suffering to the civilian population, as has increasingly been the case in recent days, can no longer be justified as a fight against Hamas terrorism. When lines are crossed, where international humanitarian law is now really being violated, then Germany, the German Chancellor, must also say something about it.
So the German Chancellor openly criticizing the behavior of the Israeli government in Gaza. Where does that shift come from? And is it more than a new stern tone? We'll talk about how Merz and his government are repositioning Germany internationally, because he seriously shifted some gears also when it comes to Ukraine. Also this week, Germany announced it will help Ukraine build long-range missiles to strike Russian territory. Wow, that would have been unthinkable under Merz's predecessor, Olaf Scholz. And I can't wait to talk to my guests about all that. Here in the studio, we've got John Kampfner, British journalist. You write in The Guardian. And a couple of years ago, you wrote a book called How the Germans Do It Better, Notes from a Grown-Up Country. So maybe as a warm-up, John, when you look at how Friedrich Merz has been doing in those first 3 weeks, what is your assessment?
I think one of the most remarkable things and curious things about Germany is the propensity to see the glass always, not just as half empty, but as sort of three quarters, nine tenths empty. This is a country that almost can never say anything good about itself. And Friedrich Merz was condemned before he even took up the job. And it should be said, he made a couple, well, certainly one major mistake on the road when he briefly flirted with the AfD. I think in the first 3 or 4 weeks, he has performed strongly. And I'm not entirely convinced that this new statement on Israel means very much. I hope it does. I find, again, one of the problems I have with current Germany is the paralysis that it has been laboring under when it comes to the Middle East. And the paralysis comes from its history. And it is still unable to take a strong, objective view to Israel, differentiating criticism of the Netanyahu government from anti-Semitism. Is this a start from Friedrich Merz? Time will tell.
And we will try and find out just how much substance there is, or whether it really is possibly some sort of a rhetorically different style that Friedrich Merz is using. And Richard, you're a familiar face, of course, with the Berlin Briefing community. Richard Walker here, DW's chief international editor, and you're fresh off the plane. You accompanied the German foreign minister, the new one, Johann Wadephul, also from the Conservatives, like Friedrich Merz, on his first trip to Washington. If you want to give us just a quick idea of how is that different? You also traveled with Annalena Baerbock. If you had to compare these two in style.
Yeah, I mean, Nina, I should correct you. You said fresh off the plane. I'm off the plane. I don't know. I'm not feeling that fresh. This was an 18-hour trip on the ground. It had that in common with trips with Annalena Baerbock and any German foreign minister, really. You know, you're kind of rushing around. So you cross the Atlantic for 18 hours. I once went with Olaf Scholz on a day trip to Beijing. I mean, it can be pretty crazy. But in terms of style, the new guy, Johann Wadephul, is very, very different from Annalena Baerbock, his predecessor. Annalena Baerbock was in her 40s. She was young. She still is.
She's taking on this job in New York now for the UN.
Yeah, that's right. So, and she really kind of, she really made quite an impact internationally in being this kind of fresh face of Germany and setting a lot of, you know, priorities. She's from the Green Party, so environmental stuff was up there. Also talking about human rights quite a bit. You know, when she came in to office, she talked about having a kind of a values-driven foreign policy.
Feminist
foreign policy. If you look at Johann Wadephul now, he's in his early 60s, very different kind of impression. He's not as kind of, you know, sort of energetic, punchy, but setting some quite different tonalities. So he said in his first speech that he wants to have an interest-driven foreign policy. And he didn't say, you know, out with the values, that's a load of nonsense. But, you know, implicit was we've spent too much time on issues of human rights, feminism and so on, and we need to get back to hard tacks of what is in Germany's interest. So that's kind of a bit of the tone that's different from the two of them. But, you know, his big project is try to build a functioning relationship with the Trump administration, you know, ride this tiger in some way. And for him, that means having a good relationship with Marco Rubio. So that was what this trip was all about, really. A first visit to Marco Rubio. He got 15 minutes of FaceTime, just head to head, plus 30 minutes with his delegation. So it was a long way to go for a pretty short meeting. There was no joint press conference, but Rubio so far has not done a joint press conference within Washington. And it looks like, there was a press statement from Johann Vadeful afterwards trying to emphasize the ways in which they're cooperating, the positive messages that he brought. All that there was from Marco Rubio was a brief readout afterwards. But there was a sense that there were a lot of elephants in the room, and they were big and they were standing on each other's shoulders. And are they even going to? Yeah. So can they tackle the major kind of ideological rift that is very visible at the moment between Germany and the US? Can they bridge that? We don't know yet. But this was a first attempt. Next up will be Friedrich Merz himself going to Washington. There's some chatter that that could happen next week even.
Yeah, so a lot on Friedrich Merz's plate, obviously. We've got on the line over also in Berlin, Stefan Detjen. Stefan, so good that you could join us here.
Yes, happy to be here.
Podcast. So you're Deutschlandfunk's chief political correspondent and the head of German Public Radio's politics department here. And you've been observing, you know, the various German governments in the last couple of decades. And I was just wondering, you've published so much on Germany's relationship with Israel and on, you know, that concept of Staatsräson. As a German native, how would you describe what that principle of Staatsräson means and how that principle, so that very unique relationship that Germany has with the state of Israel, how that has evolved, how that is being challenged since the 7th of October 2023 when Hamas attacked Israel?
Well, the term reason of state, of course, was coined in relation to Israel by Angela Merkel in a speech she gave at the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. And at that time, it was a completely foreign policy term and expressed, I found it very convincing because I felt expressed to a certain degree the way of Germanness I was part of, being a child of West Germany, grew up in Cologne in West Germany. I was raised with this German education, which was focused on the story of the Nazi period, the Shoah, the murdering of the European Jews. And I thought, well, this is something which marks my identity as a German in a very broad sense. At the same time, I always believed that this term, reason of state, cannot be used as a voucher for any like concrete measures in case Israel is endangered. Israelis and some Germans criticized the term or understood it from the beginning on. This means if we are in danger, Germany will deliver this or this weapon, be it missiles, be it tanks. But I'm sure at the time Angela Merkel didn't mean it in that way. And I think only in that very broad way as describing a German attitude, this term makes sense. What we are seeing now and what we saw since October 7th is that the term was used to in a very concrete sense to justify measures of German politics in the realm of foreign policy, justifying, for example, German weapons deliveries to Israel, even though many people know this is in conflict with international law. And we shouldn't forget that not only since October 7th, but even before, and this is something I criticized, that the term was more and more used in the realm of domestic politics, Staatsräson, justifying means in the inner German discourse on Israel and antisemitism, concretely the idea, the notion that Staatsräson might be something that even allows to restrict fundamental rights like freedom of speech or academic freedoms, which is also in open contradiction to the values and the rules of the German contradiction. But this is the conflict we see. So we see the debate playing out in foreign politics and in interior politics, in domestic politics in Germany as well.
Yeah, John, you wanted to say something on that. I'm just wondering, because I've got two Brits here in the studio who've lived in Germany for a long time. What was it like to come to this country when, you know, me as myself, also like Stefan, I grew up in West Germany. So to me, it was an obvious thing for decades, right? Israel as a state has to exist. And oh my God, if the Israeli government does something bad, then people are struggling in Germany. So how would you describe what you experienced?
For me, it's close up and personal. So my father was a Jewish refugee from Bratislava, which was then Czechoslovakia. He escaped through the skin of his teeth in the summer of 1939, going all the way through Germany and out again to Belgium and ending up in the UK. And various members of his extended families were killed in the camps. And for me, and I was a correspondent in Germany, in Bonn and East Berlin, and then reacquainted myself with Germany
during the Cold War, right?
During the Cold War, when the wall came down, I was based in the Leipziger Straße in an old sort of Stasi Hochhaus, and I saw it all. I saw unification, then I left for Moscow. Anyway, came back after Brexit, because to me that was the terrible caesura. I had never had to ask myself the question, are you a Brit or are you a European? I always thought the two things were synonymous. And I came here, and I am now very much imprinted with the idea of being a great German sort of Befürworter. I mean, you know, I do love this country. I'm a German citizen now. Aber I find what has happened since the 7th of October in terms of German public discourse deeply worrying, in the extent that I always thought that Germany had dealt with Vergangenheitsbewältigung, with coming to terms with its history, had gone through the tunnel, learned all the lessons, absorbed all the responsibility, and come out again. And what has really bothered me is being lectured to by certain Germans in the last 2 years, since October the 7th, about why I wasn't being more supportive of Israel. Because as far as I was concerned, Netanyahu is a far-right leader, as bad as any of the far-right leaders are out there in the world. And to say that, you know, it goes without saying that what Hamas did on October the 7th was absolutely horrific in all respects.
And that they're still holding people hostage.
So there's no but, there's an and. Mm. And the Israeli response was completely out of all proportion and getting worse all the time, and the use of starvation as a war tactic is in violation against all norms and is a war crime. I'm pleased these tiny, tiny steps that Merz is taking. The Brits, the French and the Canadians criticised Israel a few weeks earlier. Frankly, I don't think any of it makes the blindest bit of difference to Netanyahu. The only relationship he is interested with is the US and Trump. However, I do think the German response at the moment is not really relevant when it comes to the Middle East, but it is relevant when it comes to the future of German society. And Germany understanding that in order, which pertains to Ukraine as well, in order to defend Western liberal values, you have to be robust against whoever is violating them.
Mm. And Richard, what do you think caused this change in tone in Merz? Johann Badefuhl was also very outspoken. So what was different? Because, I mean, you know, people in other countries have been criticising Israel very, very vocally for months now, you know.
Yeah.
And they've always said, as John just laid out, that this goes far beyond self-defence. This doesn't appear to be a strategy that is functional when it comes to trying to bring hostages back home. So what's different now? Merz sounded very different when he first took office. He still said, you know, we're standing by Israel's side, and he reminded everybody of the atrocities that Hamas committed on the 7th of October. And now suddenly, what happened last weekend?
Yeah, so I think what you would hear from them, so I was also with the foreign minister in Israel, so and that was kind of a precursor of this. that it's two things, really. It is the fact that aid has not been allowed in for such a long period, that aid was choked off in early March, and that, you know, but at the point that we were in Israel, it had then exceeded 2 months of no access for aid. So they felt that this is simply too long, and that there was a risk of starvation for people in Gaza, so that had to change. And I think it's the combination of that plus the sense that Israel was also saying, all right, we're actually going to escalate our military campaign in Gaza rather than, you know, focus on alternatives, de-escalation, ceasefire, etc. So they had this sense that two things, humanitarian supplies plus the military picture, were both going in the wrong direction. And when Vardaful, the foreign minister, was in Israel, he was talking to his Israeli counterpart and he spoke to Netanyahu about this proposal that had come up between the Americans and the Israelis to allow aid in, but through a rather curious mechanism that would involve the Israeli military, that it would not involve the UN and other independent groups were not interested in because it was too aligned with the Israeli military. They said this is not an independent setup. And Vardaful essentially said, well, we should try everything, so give it a try. And he received and they signaled, OK, by the 25th of May, this is going to be properly up and running, and that didn't happen. So that they felt that, OK, something is not going right here. We need to sharpen up our messaging. But I think in terms of the bigger picture, I think they're dealing with a dilemma that the previous government, I also kind of felt it, were traveling with Annalena Baerbock to Israel, which I did on two occasions, I think.
And I think she went 12 times.
Oh, yeah, she went a lot. I mean, this was a big focus for her. Mm-hmm. And she really sweated this question, which I think you've heard from Merz as well, that Germany has these two, and both, this stems from the Second World War. Germany has two kind of eternal commitments that stem from the crimes of the Holocaust and the Nazis. It has an eternal commitment to the Jewish people and the state of Israel. And it has an eternal commitment to international law, humanitarian law, both of which, you know, were gravely breached during the Nazi era. And that increasingly they're finding that these two commitments are in opposition to each other or in tension. And that they're trying to...
With the Netanyahu government.
Yeah, with the Netanyahu government. And the previous government never got to this point. What Merz said, which I think was so significant in those soundbites that we heard earlier, he essentially said international humanitarian law is being broken. That we never heard that from the previous government. And it's not necessarily, you know, this. You could argue, well, that's simply because of what's going on in Gaza. Now he's come to the conclusion that this combination of choking off aid plus escalating, these things in combination create a breach of international law. So, but yeah, the previous government never got to that point.
Stefan, I want to bring you back in because you know that the SPD, so Merz's coalition partners, they also have a certain thing or two to say on this matter, and not necessarily cabinet members yet, but definitely people, members of the Bundestag from the Social Democrats, are now calling for an end to weapons deliveries. And this is something where I think it gets interesting in terms of how much substance there is in this new shift in tone, because Germany continues to be Israel's second most important weapons deliverer, supplier. Yeah. So is that going to happen? What do you think?
Yes, I think it will, in one way or the other, it will happen. Also for legal reasons, because the German government, of course, has advisors, and they are certainly pointing out that if Germany is continuing weapons delivery, particularly weapons that might be used in the Gaza campaign or in the West Bank, that Germany becomes complicit. And Germany was already drawn to the International Court of Justice. And even though politicians, when you spoke to them, said, well, it's ridiculous, it's a lawsuit forwarded by Nicaragua, we knew that, for example, the international law experts in the Foreign Office took this case serious and seriously tried to argue against it, and that they also know that there are limits to the arguments they presented to the International Court of Justice. So this is one thing. Then when we are speaking about the Social Democrats, we shouldn't underestimate that parties in Germany, more or less, were divided when it came to the politics with regard to Israel, or let's call it in the broader sense, the politics of Staatsraison, of reason, of state, because it had an external and international dimension and this internal dimension. And for example, the Social Democrats were deeply divided on resolutions the German parliament passed on the implementation of Staatsraison in the field of domestic politics. When it came, there were resolutions passed demanding for a stricter control of universities and education institutions regarding the fight against anti-Semitism, and always using the term anti-Semitism as a demand for strict loyalty to Israel in this situation. So this was heavily disputed in the Social Democratic Party. The Social Democratic Party, their constituency in the German parliament, also has more than, for example, the Christian Democrats. Merz's party has members of parliament with a migrant background, which also allows them to integrate other perspectives on the world, on Germany, on the Middle East conflict into their politics. So this is playing out. And this is, I think, all a part of the effects of Merz's statement on the general German discourse. It's not only about how German chancellor or foreign minister talks to Israel and talks on the international stage. What happened in the last week, this change of tonality from the chancellor will influence the German discourse in general. And I completely agree with John, who said in the beginning that the German discourse was kind of paralyzed. And I think that might be one of the most important effects. We might see that the German discourse is changing, that we also in the media, the German media, are starting to ask other questions, that they are starting to listen to other voices which weren't heard in the German discourse, that they are in another way accepting criticism which was very easily labeled as anti-Semitic before. Hmm.
I've just, on that, I mean, Stefan, I'd just like to ask you, I mean, where do you think it would go? What is the next, if, I mean, I hope you're right, I hope there is a more robust, a more confident, a less reflexively frightened conversation in Germany, and a responsible one as well. But in political terms, where would that lead to? How would you see that? How differently would this Merzian German government look?
It's a very good and very interesting question, and I don't have a definite answer to it, but I see two pathways Germany might go, or the German discourse might go. One is that the German authorities, German government, also the German media, succeed in broadening the discourse, hearing other voices, which would be very important for the German society, because the German society itself is, meanwhile, a diverse society. In Berlin, we are living with the largest Palestinian diaspora in Europe, at least. So we need to talk, and we need to find ways to talk on these issues, to talk about different perspectives on history, on the Middle East conflict. So if media and politics are able to somehow providing the stages, the framework to have that discourse, this might be, this could be a very important development in what you described, John, in the beginning of this German memory discourse and the German identity discourse. Like, for example, accepting and talking about the fact that, of course, not only the state of Israel and the Jews were affected by German politics, but that the fate of the Palestinians also might have something to do with German behavior in the past. But the other and more negative perspective I would see is that we are just seeing ongoing polarization, and that we are seeing media and political forces, political parties, one of them might be the right-wing extremist AfD, using this dispute and using the polarization to make their political business with this polarization. I mean, we are seeing already the AfD, like many right-wing parties and populist parties, claiming to be the best and most loyal ally of Israel because it's about fighting radical Muslims and so on. And in this sense, it's very important to see how Merz's party, the CDU, will deal with this situation and how they will develop their rhetorics.
And, you know, we already spoke about the fact that Vardafol had to go to the US on Wednesday, and he made a couple of comments on Israel then. But there was a tricky situation for him because he missed the visit by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, because Marco Rubio said, all right, come on Wednesday. And then Zelensky said, I'll be in Berlin. Vattenfall said, okay, sorry, but, you know, I've got to go anyway. So we have to talk about Ukraine and Merz and Vattenfall's new position on that issue.
Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European current affairs programme, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge, bringing you a combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Join us every Thursday.
Germany funding, essentially, Ukrainian arms manufacturing, not just drones, not just ammunition. That's something that the Ukrainians are doing already anyway. But Germany is putting 5 billion euros into things like Ukraine building long-range missiles of the sort that the Ukrainian army is already using. So we're probably talking the British Storm Shadow, or we're talking the French Scalp. We don't know that yet. How much of a shift is that, Richard?
Well, I think, obviously, we're in the early days of this government, so we're seeing how the, I mean, part of it is about how they position themselves in comparison to the previous government was somewhat divided on these questions. But really, it was Olaf Scholz, the chancellor, who was very much the kind of the limiter on being out in front in terms of provision of weapons to Ukraine. So Olaf Scholz's guiding principle was really caution throughout his entire term, not just on Ukraine, but in many, many areas. Caution was pretty much his kind of brand as a politician. And he sort of, there was a sense at many stages that he had to be kind of dragged kicking and screaming to provide the next form of weaponry. And, you know, for instance, there was a very long debate on tanks, for instance, you know, this particular type of tank called a Leopard, which is a German tank. You know, you had sort of think tankers wearing Free the Leopard's t-shirts and things like that. It kind of became
those.
Almost it's kind of ridiculous. Joke. And now that seems ridiculous in retrospect. But at the time, Olaf Scholz's sort of thinking was like, oh, God, you know, if a German tank is kind of seen rolling into Russia or something, then this also goes back to German history because, you know.
But also a misreading of German history
again. Yes, yes.
Which was, you know, Nazi crimes on the Eastern Front were committed in great number
against
in the
Ukraine.
Lands that were Ukraine and Belarus as well. Whereas the entire framing of Germany's Eastern responsibilities has always been to Russia.
So it's a kind of a blending of two things. It's sort of a sense of responsibility to Russia, but also fear of Russia, you know. So, and what, you know, throughout the last couple of years, Friedrich Merz has tried to signal that he would be more hawkish, that he would be less cautious, that he would be more out front, that he would, for instance, provide these longer range cruise missiles made by German companies called Taurus. There has not yet been a clear, okay, we're going to send Taurus message, but this is sort of a little bit in that direction.
And maybe it's his way to get out of that question.
It could be, exactly.
You know, because then he doesn't have to deliver it and Ukrainians can build them.
Exactly. It's
themselves.
Not necessarily, you know, it also, you know, presents a little bit of cover. But we don't know, you know, whether he is going to continue towards that. But this is also, I think you do have to put this in connection with the picture with vis-a-vis the United States as well, because the Europeans are trying to be able to signal that, you know, if the US are going to be providing less support, that they are able to fill that gap. There cannot be a sense that there's a risk that the entire Western support is going to crumble for Ukraine, because that would obviously be extremely dangerous.
Absolutely. I was at the press conference with Ukrainian President Zelensky and Friedrich Merz this week in Berlin. And to me, what was striking was that Friedrich Merz thanked the US President Donald Trump in person for his personal activities when it came to trying to broker peace, trying to find a diplomatic way of ending the conflict. And I thought that Friedrich Merz was talking to Donald Trump in this press conference. And there was something where I'd like us all to give a listen to what Friedrich Merz said again.
There has never been more diplomacy from the European side in this war than in the last 3 weeks, and in very close coordination with President Zelensky, in close coordination with President Trump. I hope that Russia recognizes this and that they take our will to come to talks here, to come to a ceasefire and to come to peace talks seriously at all levels. If they don't do this now, they will prove to the world public that they have no serious interest in talks and want to continue this war militarily.
Stefan, what was your reading of this comment? It's just a fact that if the US were to pull out of Ukraine support, then the Europeans would have a tremendous difficulty trying to fill that gap. So, you know, did you read what Friedrich Merz said there?
Absolutely. It perfectly fits in what we heard from Friedrich Merz from the very beginning on. I traveled with Friedrich Merz on the first day of his term to Paris and Warsaw. And in Paris, of course, it was interesting to listen to him when he was giving a press conference with Emmanuel Macron. The French were expecting Friedrich Merz to repeat his offer to talk with the French about a European nuclear protection shield. But what Merz did at this moment, and we shouldn't forget that after the election, but before the parliament elected Merz as a chancellor, Emmanuel Macron, in a televised message to the French people, spoke of a historic initiative of Friedrich Merz with regard to the French nuclear protection. But in Paris, Merz said, of course, we will talk about this. I will ask my Minister of Defense to reach out to his French counterpart. And then he started addressing Trump and saying, but when it comes to Ukraine, we will need security guarantees under American leadership. So he's also offering Donald Trump this role. He is catering to Trump's desire for reputation and for respect of his European partners. So that's what's going on. And we shouldn't forget, of course, we will see Merz within the next days, I would say within the next 2 weeks or so, traveling to the White House and having his first personal conversation in the Oval Office.
And that is so pivotal. I mean, that Oval Office, Trump TV moment, will it be a sort of Zelensky-Ramaphosa showdown? I work from the assumption it won't, and the German side will ensure that Merz is properly schooled, no matter how much Trump needles him. But as we all know, Merz has a certain sort of brittleness when it comes to egos. And, you know, Trump famously had a terrible relationship with Merkel, ostentatiously terrible. And it's absolutely vital. I mean, if Merz can, in other respects, Merz and Trump could be quite similar. They, you know, before J.D. Vance's speech at the Munich Security Conference a week before the German elections, Merz was giving this impression, these two sort of tall private sector bros could
flying
with helicopters and sort of anti-woke and all this sort of stuff, we can get on just fine. Then Vance did his, and the administration made it pretty clear what they thought of Europe, Germany, liberal democracy, etc. It's going to be such, I would say, of all the meetings Trump has had, this one is so pivotal.
Especially also because we still don't know whether Donald Trump is actually going to be attending the NATO summit that's coming up in June, where, of course, the Defence Alliance is going to agree on its new goals. And we can listen to something else that Friedrich Merz said, where I thought when I heard that, it has been underreported somewhat, and I wonder whether you're sharing my opinion, because Friedrich Merz has changed the tone also when it comes to how Ukraine is defending the European way of life by saying that essentially we're all under threat, and very specifically. So let's listen to that.
The entire space in which we live is being put at risk. The political order that we established together with Russia after 1990 is being fundamentally questioned. And if that is the case, then we have reached a point where we all must defend ourselves together. We are being threatened, and we will defend ourselves against that. Under my leadership, with this federal government, there will be no doubt that we will do everything necessary to defend ourselves. It is the highest duty of every government, including mine, to defend the freedom of our countries, our territory, and our people. That is precisely the challenge we are currently facing.
So, we need to wrap up this episode with a couple of thoughts on when do you think, Richard, will Friedrich Merz come back from Washington and say, wow, that was a good meeting with Donald Trump? And you, John and Stefan, you can think about your answers. I'll ask you the same questions.
When?
To happen so that Friedrich Merz can come home and say, I did that well?
The Germans need to kind of walk quite an interesting line with the Americans, don't they? So they need to have a kind of a twin-track approach. I mean, Merz was saying immediately after the speech that John mentioned, the J.D. Vance speech at the Munich Security Conference, Merz said to Michaela, to our colleague, you know, we need to prepare for a situation where the Americans are no longer involved in European security. So they need to be preparing for that. But also, they need to try to keep the Americans on board for at least as long as possible with respect to Ukraine, but also with respect to Article 5, you know, because the Europeans are not ready to fully support Ukraine just without the Americans, and they're certainly not ready to fully defend themselves if the Americans completely bail out. So they need a twin-track approach. And this all really comes down to investment, you know, that there's decades of underinvestment in the European militaries. And the Americans, I mean, I was in D.C. around the time of the election, and a lot of the Republicans were saying to us, if you guys are all so scared of Putin, why do you spend 1.9% of your GDP on defense? So essentially what we heard from Merz there in that soundbite, I think, is partly preparing the German people. We need to spend a lot more on defense because this is a threat to us, and being very explicit about that. But this is also a message to the White House. We are taking your demand seriously. We recognize that we've underinvested in defense. We recognize that we've not pulled our weight in NATO. We will do that. And please, in return, stick around. Yeah. The stick around bit, of course, we don't know. I mean, Trump is so impulsive. We don't know what his long-term strategy is. So we don't know if it'll work out. I think the fortunate thing for the Germans is, to keep the Americans sticking around, you need to spend a lot more on defense. If the Americans don't stick around, you need to spend a lot more on defense. So either way, whatever happens, you need to spend a lot more on defense.
And the number that's doing the rounds is, of course, 5% of GDP, but that would be divided between 3.5 on defense and 1.5 in infrastructure.
Yeah, so they're crossing their fingers that Trump is going to accept that kind of asterisk on the 5%, because Trump came out saying 5%, and they're saying, well, maybe 3.5 on that and 1.5 on that. So
maybe Germany will have to buy American bridges.
They might be buying a lot of American weapons, yeah.
Or trains. Stefan, your thoughts?
Well, I think Merz will be successful in Washington when he leaves the Oval Office, gives a press conference, and can say, I'm very grateful that Donald Trump assured me that the United States will continue to support Ukraine, that they will stay engaged in Europe and Ukraine. And he will say that he assured the American president that Germany knows about its obligation, that he, as Richard said, that his government will spend more on defense. And in this sense, his words will remind me of what Angela Merkel said when he visited Donald Trump. But because, of course, already at that time, they had the same discussions, the same issues were on the table.
John.
The test of leadership is being mindful of public opinion, but not being led by public opinion, which is what Olaf Scholz, to your point earlier, Richard, did. The Zeitenwende, the decision of Germany a few days after Putin invaded Ukraine, could have been and should have been the moment, because public opinion was briefly completely behind what Olaf Scholz did, which was a calculated
even the opposition
risk, and was a brilliant thing to do. It was definitely the high point in Scholz's leadership. I hope from these early, we've been talking about all manner of things, but from all the early indications from Merz and the clip that you just used when he was at the Nordic Council, I think is really, really interesting. And if Merz is willing to say to the German people, look, you guys, this is what we've got to do, and we are just going to do it, and we've got to do it, and you need to be behind this, rather than doing what Scholz did, and to an extent doing what Merkel did, and looking over his shoulder all the time, then I think we might be looking at a very different and more confident Germany in a few years' time.
And then you can write another book about the grown-up Germany.
Exactly. Then I can feel more vindicated. I must admit, there were certain times under the Scholz regime when I began to wobble. But I'm a little bit more confident now. But I've never been... it's never been without caveats.
Well, thank you very much to everyone watching wherever you found us on YouTube or listening on your podcast platforms. And we'll be back with a fresh episode next week. And you can also subscribe to our newsletter that comes out once a week, where we go into details about, you know, things that are happening in Germany or the German government's perspective on all things that matter. So do subscribe. If you like this podcast, then just send us a comment as well. And we look forward to seeing you again.